at www.biscom.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, we're going to be talking about and listening to the wide range of musical traditions from the Islamic world. Our guest is internationally acclaimed composer and performer Simone Shaheen. Simone Shaheen began his performing career at the age of 5 as a young Palestinian in Israel. He's dedicated most of his adult career to bringing the true sounds of Middle Eastern music to American audiences. He joins us from New York City. Simone Shaheen, we have heard so much of war and politics for the last few months. It's wonderful to have some time to spend with you looking at music of the Middle East and the Islamic world.
Yes, I love this idea as the center of our communication rather than politics and wars.
It's a great break to have. We should understand your background a bit first. You're Palestinian. You grew up in Israel. Now you live in New York. Musically, you're a citizen of the world, but especially of the Arab world, the Islamic world. Where did your love affair with this music begin?
Actually, it began in my little village. And this village is called Tarshiha in the northern part of the Galilee in proper Israel. And I started listening to this music basically since the day one I was born, because I was born to a musical family. My father was a fantastic oud player and composer and music educator. And his family, the Shaheen family, was known as musical family. His brothers, his sisters were great voices. So at the age of 3, I remember, I started to hold the oud and, you know, just imitate my father. And I would say maybe half year later, I started to play the instrument. My first performance was at the age of 5 on a stage in front of 2,000 people.
So even then, you were probably starting ahead of many of us. It's a great place to begin, perhaps. We're all, or many of us, beginners in this genre of music. Give us a simple lesson and sort of walk us into where a beginner might begin with this music of the Middle East.
Yeah, when we say the music of the Middle East, this is a very vast region, and it has many components and many sub-regions. Middle East could involve the Levant area, which is the East Mediterranean.
Lebanon, like, Syria, Jordan.
Lebanon, exactly, and even Egypt. Mm-hmm. And then you have the North African segment, which includes, Libya, Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. Middle Eastern music cover more the eastern parts, such as Iraq and Saudi Arabia, the Gulf area, Southern Peninsula. Then if we move further, you have Turkey, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and even Indian music would fall under the larger scheme of the Middle East.
Simone Shaheen, take us back to your childhood then, to the Levant, in your case, in what is Israel today. And you've got the oud. You were 5 years old when you began. Describe for us what the oud looks like.
The oud is the... Just to make it easier to envision it, mm-hmm. for Western listeners, it's the ancestor of the lute. Mm-hmm. It looks exactly like the Western classical lute. It's plucked instrument, mm-hmm. Where you use both hands, the right and the left. Mm-hmm. It's like, imagine the guitar, mm-hmm. but it has a kind of semi-round back, and then you have the top, which we call in Arabic the face, or al-wajh. Mm-hmm. You have an upper fingerboard with no frets, the metal dividers on the guitar. Mm-hmm. I use in the right hand the pick to strum the strings. And basically they would include 5 double strings and 1 bass or a drone string.
We think we picture it. So Simone Shaheen, take us on our first lesson. Give us the basics maybe of the scale that you would have learned as a boy in Israel.
I would like to make the distinction here that we are talking about Arabic music in
Understood.
This case. Yeah. And when I started, more listening to Palestinian folkloric music, mm-hmm. listening to Egyptian and Syrian traditional and classical music, and, of course, my father's own music. And you will have this sound.
Thank you. Simon Shaheen on the oud, the instrument he began playing as a young Palestinian boy in Israel. How would you place that particular riff of music, Simon Shaheen? Would that be music of the Levant or just a broader Arabic tune?
Yeah, it's the Levant area. And what I played, I just play simple one-phrase improvisation. And I use the scale that is very, you know, it's easy for the Western ear to hear, which is like the minor scale. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing in our music, and in large in the Arabic music, is that in terms of the scales, and we have something called modes, and the modes are comparable to the scales. In Arabic, we call them maqamat, and this is the plural, and the singular will be maqam. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about the maqam is that it has intervals that includes microtonalities, these very, very sensitive and small intervals that, from my experience here in the West, the Western ear will have a very difficult time to hear it. And if they hear it, some people try to comprehend that, other hear it as an out-of-tune quality. And maybe I will demonstrate some of this.
Please do. I suppose this is what gives that special color to the music that we hear.
Definitely. And this is why Arabic music is so rich, melodically speaking. It's horizontal melodic music. And when we have in the West, the whole Western music is based on two scales, the major and the minor. Mm-hmm. In Arabic music, we have more than 100 modes or maqamat. For example,
show us, yeah.
If I play just minor scale, and if I play this, just if you count with me, 1, 2, 3, 4. So 3 is very simple. You can hear this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
While if I play this number 3 slightly sharper, you will hear the following. You hear the difference?
And the mood is immediately changed.
And the quality changes. And, you know, the whole concept of listening is totally different.
So tell us, Simon Shaheen, this is not music that has historically been written down. So this is all passed from teacher to student?
It's both. This music is very well documented throughout the Arab history since the beginning, even prior to Islam. And part of this music also is passed traditionally, you know, by ear, especially the idea or the concept of taqasim, which is the improvisation. Mm. This is not something that you document because it depends very much on the creation of music at the moment of the performance. And this is the beauty of it.
So is improvisation, then, in Middle Eastern music similar to jazz improvisation, where the musicians are cueing and playing off one another in the process of making the music?
No, it is more, it's freer, it's free improvisation. Mm-hmm. It's more elaborate in terms of the use of the maqam system, or let's call it the modal system, mm-hmm. scale system, with all these microtonalities, or what we call quarter tones. It is, I would say, it's more embellished, because since this music is very horizontal, very melodic, the thing that enrich it is the use of ornaments, something that we don't hear much in Western classical or or even traditional music.
Let us hear some of that ornamentation.
I will play a phrase of an improvisation. Mm-hmm. Let's say I play it as a skeleton without the ornaments.
Okay.
So if I repeat this, mm-hmm. So there is a huge difference in both approaches.
Huge, and it brings even to an untutored ear, it brings a region to life. You early on heard, like millions of others in the Middle East, the voice of Umm Kulthum. How did that figure into your first sense of what this music could be?
Umm Kulthum was one of the greatest singers in the 20th century in Arabic music, and she's Egyptian. She was born in a little village in the suburbs of Cairo, and then when she moved to Cairo, and this is when she started her career.
How did you hear her? Did you hear her on the radio or on recordings?
I heard many old recordings that my father had. Basically, what he played for me, the music of Umm Kulthum, people like Umm Kulthum, Muhammad Abdul Wahab, another great, the Stravinsky of Egyptian music in the 20th century, and even older music from, it goes back to 1902. We have records from that period.
Let's listen to a little bit of Umm Kulthum to have a sense of what you might have heard as a boy listening to records or the radio. Mm-hmm. Simon Shaheen, what are we hearing here? There's passion, there's pathos, longing, maybe sorrow. Interpret this for us.
Yeah, she's talking, the lyrics here addressing the male. It says that you who's forgetting me and don't remember me anymore. So she's addressing the person who's forgetting her. And what's interesting here is you hear this quality of singing, which basically derives from the Quranic school of recitation.
In the rhythm of the reciting?
No, I'm talking about the quality of the sound, voice, the projection, the control of these little ornaments I was discussing, which are very difficult to produce.
And this sort of quavering tone, is that intentional? Is that related to what you're describing?
Oh, yes, of course. These are ornaments. You know, the slidings, the trills, the little embellishments that you hear in the voice.
So this comes from the traditional style of reciting the Quran.
Reciting the Quran, and Umm Kulthum and Muhammad Abdul Wahab were two singers, vocalists, who since their childhood they learned the vocalization. By learning the Quran recitation. And in Quranic recitation, all these elements, the knowledge of the Arabic modal system, the knowledge of the ornaments in Arabic music, the knowledge of the use of the voice, and the idea of projection, it's all there. And Abdul Wahab and Kulthum, definitely, what made them into great singers, their childhood and their background in Quranic recitation.
Simon Shaheen, hold on a moment. We need to take a short break. Listeners, you can learn more about the Middle Eastern instrument, the oud, at our website. Go to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, our guest is internationally acclaimed composer and performer Simon Shaheen. Simon Shaheen, is there a deeper or more explicit connection between music and religion in the Middle East and the Islamic world than in the West?
I would say both they have their connections. I mean, we know that in Western music there is great connection between Western secular music and sacred music. I mean, all these great giants who composed Western classical music in Europe, such as Bach, for example, or Beethoven, they composed a fantastic, religious music. All these oratorios, and so. I would say, yeah, they are comparable in those terms. But, you know, the connections are different because these are the two different cultures.
What is the difference in that connection?
We have to think of the system, the musical system in both worlds. They follow different paths. While in the Arabic musical theory, we have this concept of the microtonalities, the concept of embellishment. In Western music, you find that instead of the emphasis on the melody, the emphasis is much more harmonically. And the music itself, when it's played with these what we call counterpoints, melodies, interweaving together in harmonic fashion, they create this subtlety, the rhythmic subtlety in the music. Then the total perception is different.
Play something that speaks to that point. Maybe on your violin, if you would. I know you have both there.
I would like to maybe start with Arabic.
Oh, right? please, yes.
If I were to play a short improvisation on the violin using an Arabic model or maqam system, and again, improvisation, taqasim, the concept of taqasim is the creation of the moment. I never prepared this, what I'm going to play for you. But of course, in improvisation, this is only a short example. But when the improvisation develops, it becomes much more intricate, much more interesting, a great deal of tension and release, modulations between all these fantastic modes. Now, if I play something from Bach, for example. So let's say if we take a few measures from the first sonata number 1 in G. It goes like this. When I play this kind of, let's say, Bach on the violin, it's very much a bulk of notes that moving, you know, together, moving in harmonic fashion. So you want to be able to listen to number of sounds moving together. I mean, the greatest illustration would be on an organ or piano or symphonic orchestras when you hear this continuously. But in Arabic music, it's not necessary for our ear to hear so many notes in order to get the same expression. It's enough to listen to this melody with intricate intervals that don't exist in Western music that will probably would give you, in the context of your living, the same effect.
Simon Shaheen, we'd love it if you'd give us a kind of a musical tour across this region, right from North Africa through Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. But let's start with your home in the Levant. Give us some archetypal music from that region and explain to us what makes it unique to that area.
There is the music. There are so many common aspects of the Arabic music in this region. In other words, you will see many similar patterns, you know, between, let's say, Syrian music and Egyptian music, specifically. And in general, there are some regional differences. Or if you are talking about the Levant in general, we have music there that goes back to, I'm aware very much of music since the 7th and 8th century. And we practice a genre of music that is called the Muwashah. And this is the music that started in Baghdad and flourished very much in Andalusia around the beginning of the late 8th, beginning of 9th century.
So in Muslim Spain?
In Muslim Spain, yes. And this for example, this genre, the Muwashah, it's a vocal genre. It's very elaborate in terms of the poetry and the music, as opposed to the music and the poetry which came out of Arabia, which was based on the desert. So a lot of imagination and imagery. We find these two aspects very much.
And this music has now become characteristic of the Eastern Mediterranean, the Levant?
Yeah, I mean, as classical vocal music, this is very much characteristic of the Levant and North Africa. So the Muwashah as a vocal genre is a fantastic, repertoire, vocal repertoire.
We have a recording of you with the two tenors. Would that be a good sample of this music?
Yeah, actually, if you listen to Sabah Fakhri.
قطعة سماء عالأرض تاني ما إلى لوحات الله
What is the imagery there that brings the traditions of the Levant and I guess, right out of Andalusian, Muslim Spain, to mind?
You have the desert imagery, which basically the imaginary. While when music moved to the Levant and then Spain, you know, poets started to reflect the surroundings. I mean, talking about mountains, the greenery, the water. And wine, a lot of poetry related to wine and drinking wine and enjoying life, enjoying arts and culture in general. So this is basically what the poetry engulfs. Musically speaking, you will hear more elaborate melodies and rhythms, for example, as opposed to rhythms that we hear the basic rhythm of two beats and four beats. You find in this kind of music, this vocal Levant Andalusian, you find elaborate rhythms that goes to 10 beats per cycle or 14 or 21 beats per cycle. So in those terms, it's very complicated.
But when we get to the Arabian Gulf, then you come to the desert imagery that you referred to.
Definitely.
What's a classic example of that music that might show us, let us hear that sound?
Of course, the voice. Since the beginning of Islam or even pre-Islam, there were so many vocalists who happened to be at the same time poets. And even the poetry, the classical qasida or the classical Arabic poetry, is based very much on chanting the poetry or singing the poetry. So the voice is definitely the number one item that we hear there. Then you have instruments such as the nai, which is the bamboo flute. You have other instruments, string instruments, such as the orgul, which is a bowed instrument that you put on your knee and you play it as a violin. Imagine a violin that you put on your knee and then you bow mm-hmm. playing it. Mm-hmm. Of course, the rhythms. There are so many rhythmic instruments, especially in the Gulf area and the southern peninsula, that are so elaborate. And
can you play something for us that would be an archetypal Gulf area tune?
Maybe I'll play something on the oud.
That's beautiful. Let's move north and east into what was Persia or Iran, now Afghanistan, Pakistan. How does that music then present a different face from the Gulf region's music?
Again, we have always to refer to the rhythmic quality and the melodic quality of this region. And here we are talking about the music. If we have to look at it theoretically speaking, beside looking at, of course, listening to the poetry. The poetry could include different subjects and topics. I would say that we have similarities with their modal systems and rhythmic systems in general. But when you come to the specifics, then you will notice that there are great differences that makes this region or this Persian music into its own music.
Let's
that
sample.
Is separate from the Arabic world. Mm,
let's sample a bit of that right now. Traditional Iranian music, Simon Shaheen.
That's interesting. Mm. Yeah, you heard, the use of string instruments such as the violins. Mm-hmm. I would say maybe 15 to 20 violin players, and maybe 3 or 4 cellos players. And then we heard the very traditional instruments doing some small solos in between.
Yes.
And they also the traditional rhythms there. And, for example, in this Iranian music that we heard, I heard the sitar, I heard the santur, I heard the rhythmic instruments there, which is similar to the Arabic dumbak.
So it's a real world music of a kind. You've got the Western instruments blended right in with everything, including sitar.
Very interesting. And this is very much... if you listen to music from the 50s and up in the Arab world, or Persian music, or even Indian music, you hear this influence of using the string instruments, such as the violins and the cellos, together with the traditional instruments, creating this a fabulous different sound. This doesn't mean that there are no only traditional instruments used in traditional performance.
Of course, that was music of Sharam Nazeri and the ensemble Alizadeh. Let's listen for a moment, since Afghanistan has been so much on our minds, to a bit of Afghan music, and I'd like to get your interpretation, place it in the great broader tradition for us. Does this have a folk music sound to you?
Yeah, for me this sounds more traditional folkloric music. And it's amazingly based on a maqam that we have in Arabic music. It's called Kurd, K-U-R-D, which is comparable to the Phrygian in Western terms. And we have the same maqam or mode in Indian music. And it's called in Indian music Bhairavi. So it's the same mode that is used in the three musics.
Let's jump all the way across now to North Africa and get some flavor for the music there. We've got a bit of Gnawa music from sintir player Ahmed Bakbu. Tell us something about this Gnawa music. This is Moroccan?
It is Moroccan now, but it's more African. It's from the desert, and this music is folkloric music that is based on sacred lyrics. It's religious. And basically, it's religious music that prays God.
Let's listen. Wow, how interesting. As an American, as soon as you get the African element involved, I hear it. I can relate directly to it. I guess that's a common link between American music and the music of the region that you're so well versed in.
Yeah, probably because of the pentatonic scale there. It makes it easier for the American listener to hear.
But it leaves me thinking Mingus, you know. I mean, suddenly I...
Of course.
Simone Shaheen, we need to take a short break. Hold on a moment. Listeners, we aren't taking any phone calls this hour, but you can join a conversation about the music of the Middle East on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, our guest is internationally acclaimed composer and performer Simone Shaheen. You're now performing with a group called Kantara, which translated from Arabic means arch. What's the mission of Kantara? I know you're always on a mission, Simone Shaheen.
Before I answer this, I'll just say a few words about since 1980 up to now, this is 20 years.
Yeah.
Of time, I have been introducing and performing, composing Arabic music in its very traditional classical sense. I remember when I arrived here, I heard a lot of what they call the cabaret music. It was basically Greek and Turkish and a little bit of Arabic mixed together, and they call it the cabaret music. And people heard it as Arabic music, and it didn't represent for me Arabic music. Or American composers composing for Hollywood, Arabic music. So I felt that it was important to start performing and give the American people what they deserve, to listen to the truth, the true Arabic music, classical, traditional Arabic music. Then living in New York and meeting all these fantastic musicians from different parts of the world, you know, evoked a certain image in my mind, and this image was
to do something in collaboration with different musicians from different parts of the world that I call now My Music with the Kantara. And the Kantara is the group of musicians who came together and perform this kind of music with me. Many people try to call this music maybe fusion, or I don't see it myself as fusion. I see it as the collaboration of different traditions in it as a new genre.
And does it move beyond Middle Eastern music to incorporate Western music as well?
Or yeah, it does.
By the same name, by Kantara. It's a compelling sound, Simon Shaheen.
So what I'm doing here, basically, I'm playing in the oud. Blue Flame is a composition. If you listen to the entire composition, you hear two themes. And the first theme, allowing the saxophone to maybe play the theme again and again in different fashions, improvisational fashion. And then we move to the second theme, which changes rhythm and modulating to a different mode or scale, allowing the oud to improvise on a bed of rhythmic or metric segment there. And towards the end, we go back to the opening, but with slight difference. So this is Blue Flame.
Simon Shaheen, I want to hear a little more music for you before we go, but talk to us just for a second about September 11th. Mm-hmm. The events of that day and the aftermath have led Americans to open their minds to the Islamic world in a new way. What feelings has it left you with, and have they made their way into your music?
It was very painful, at the beginning, very disturbing, and it was, as many Americans think, that it's like the first time that this untouchable empire was hit with something from the outside. Then the first Sunday after the event, I played in memorial at the Riverside Church, and it was on PBS nationally, alive with other artists.
Can you play for us some of that?
The piece I played there?
Yes.
Actually, it's called Prayer. It is from music that I composed for a film by the United Nations commemorating the 50th anniversary of the human rights. And the theme, and I felt that this was, fantastic forum for playing this music.
We'd love to hear that. But before you play, I want to thank you, Simon Shaheen, for being with us this hour and for airing on this Thanksgiving Day. Simon Shaheen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Listeners, continue the conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This week, we're taking a close look at Islam's holy book, the Quran, to better understand the Islamic faith in the wake of the events of September 11th. So far, we've heard an overview, talked about the role of God in the Quran, and parsed good and evil through its verses. Tonight, we talk about the similarities and differences between the Quran and the Bible.
Surely those who believe, those who are Jewish, the Christians, and the converts, anyone who believes in Allah and believes in the last day and leads a righteous life will receive their recompense from the Lord. They have nothing to fear, nor will they grieve.
Since the events of September 11th, many have focused on where and how Islam is different from other monotheistic faiths. Although there are differences, many are surprised to learn of the deep connections between the Quran and the Bible. In fact, Moses, Adam, Noah, Mary, even Jesus, all appear in the Quran. To talk about the similarities and differences between the Quran and the Bible, we're joined by Jane McAuliffe, Dean of Arts and Sciences at Georgetown University. She's also a general editor of the Encyclopedia of the Quran. Welcome, Jane McAuliffe.
Good evening, Tom.
Muslims refer to themselves, Christians, and Jews all as people of the book. What does that mean? What's the relationship between the Quran and the Bible historically and in terms of Islamic theology?
Well, the designation, people of the book, is a way of distinguishing in Muslim eyes those groups of people who have been granted a divine revelation as opposed to those who have not. So that's what joins Christians and Jews with Muslims, is the idea that they're all part of one long stream of revelation. God has, in his goodness, revealed himself, revealed his guidance to humankind through the whole period of human history with, of course, the Quran being the final revelation.
So that's the link, but Christians and Jews are accustomed to overlapping and, in fact, shared texts in the Bible. Is there anything shared between the Quran and the Torah or Bible?
A great deal. A lot of the prophet narratives that we're familiar with from the Bible and much of the basic narrative of the Hebrew Bible is present also in the Quran, so that you'll find material on Noah and the flood. You'll find it on Abraham, on Moses and the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt.
So not specifically the same text or actual readings, but the same subjects treated in each.
The same subjects, often in a much more abbreviated form. It's the general view of scholars, both, I would say, Muslim and non-Muslim, that Muhammad must certainly have been living in an environment that was what we might call story-saturated, and that he was familiar with a kind of common store of narrative material in the milieu of both Mecca and Medina. And much of this material is shared biblical narrative. But the reason we make that assumption is that he can simply point to, or the Quran can simply point to them in a very abbreviated form. So obviously the revelations were being preached to a group of people who could fill in the blanks.
So when the Quran tells these stories, how do they present key figures? Take us through some of them, maybe Moses, Mary, Jesus, others. How does the portrayal in the Quran compare to that in the Bible?
Well, I think the figure of Moses, for example, would be quite familiar to readers of the Hebrew Bible, a strong, heroic figure.
A Jew?
Yes, well, an Israelite, and one responsible for the salvation of his people. The whole story of Moses and of the Exodus from Egypt is found in the Quran, and it's also told in several different parts of the Quran. Jesus is presented very sympathetically, but Jesus is presented as a prophet, not as the Son of God. In fact, the notion that such a statement could be made about Jesus is denied. But again, Christians reading the Quranic depiction of the Jesus story would certainly recognize it. Jesus was born of a virgin. He's represented as the Word of God, as a kind of spirit from God. His mission confirms that of the Torah. Even the notion that Jesus distanced himself from some of the content of the Mosaic Law is represented.
What about Mary's portrayal? She actually overshadows Jesus as a figure in the Quran, does she not?
Well, to the extent that there are probably more verses devoted to the Mary story than to the Jesus story.
Why would that be?
That's a good question, and I don't think that scholars have ever adequately responded to that. There is something about the story as narrative that was clearly very appealing, especially about Mary's youth and her giving birth to Jesus. She's named in the Quran far more than in the New Testament.
Is there anything that you could recite for us there?
This is from the 19th surah or chapter of the Quran, which is called Maryam. It's named after Mary. And remember the account of Mary in the book when she withdrew from her people to an eastern place. She screened herself away from them, and we sent to her our spirit and it appeared to her in the form of a well-shaped human being. She said, "I seek refuge with God from you if you fear God." He said, "I am only the messenger of your Lord to grant you a boy most pure." She said, "Shall I have a boy when no man has touched me and I have not been an unchaste woman?" He said, "Thus it will be. Your Lord has said, this is an easy matter for me, that we may make him a sign unto mankind and a mercy from us." And thus it was decreed.
It is a beautiful...
So that's an Annunciation mm-hmm. account. Or
a beautiful and a very familiar telling of that story. A couple of other things just quickly. Do the Bible and the Quran share the same story of Genesis?
Yes, without the notion of an original sin that is then passed down from generation to generation as a sort of burden or an inner corruption of the human being, in some ways a diminishment.
So the Quran does not have the notion of original sin?
No, it doesn't. But
that seems like a fundamental theological difference, isn't it?
It is. There are a number of fundamental theological differences. The Quranic denial of the crucifixion.
It's explicitly denied in the Quran?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is, in two places. This is from the fourth surah or chapter. It says, "And they're saying, they're being the Jews, mm-hmm. we have killed the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, and the apostle of God. They neither killed nor crucified him, but it was made to appear so unto them. Mm-hmm. Indeed, those who differ about him are in doubt about it. Their knowledge does not go beyond conjecture. And they did not kill him for certain. Rather, God raised him unto himself. God is mighty and wise."
So there's a fundamental, very interesting difference. Does this or anything else in the Quran suggest that a clash between followers of these different books is inevitable or necessary or not?
No, I don't think it does. And there's far more similarity than there is difference. I think there are far more grounds for concord and harmony than for clash.
And yet we've had centuries of conflict.
Well, we've also had centuries of intra-Christian conflict. I mean, religion doesn't obviate conflict. And sure, there are ways of interpreting any scripture that can lead to a conflictual situation. But I don't think it's of the nature of these texts that Muslims and other peoples of the book need necessarily be in conflict.
Professor McAuliffe, do you have a favorite passage or verse that you might send us off with?
I think one that would help to point to this whole notion of the Quran as being the final revelation and as really confirming earlier revelations is one that we might look at for a moment. There's a verse in the 10th surah of the Quran, verse 94, that goes like this. "So if you are in doubt concerning what we have revealed to you, then ask those who have been reading the book before you. Indeed, the truth has come to you from your Lord, so do not be one of the doubters." I think that helps to tie it together as effectively as anything I could point to.
Professor McAuliffe, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome.
Jane McAuliffe is the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Georgetown University. She's also General Editor of the Encyclopedia of the Quran. Tomorrow, in the final night of our Quran series, we'll discuss the intersection of Islam and the September 11th terrorist attacks. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.